Yep, the recorder is now running.
Okay, so let's turn to 1875 and the socialist parties in Germany that merge over the Lasallian program at Goethe. Unfortunately, what happens in Goethe does not stay in Goethe. It sets the ground in the direction of much of the Marxist movement for the next 140 years. Now, Marx had published Volume 1 of Capital in 1867, and he's working with the Eisenacher Party, which was founded in 1869. But to his dismay, what happens at Goethe reveals that not even his co-leaders can see the organizational consequences of the sea change that his writings have brought about, and his own party reps ally with the Lasallian Party and approve a program that Marx calls a retrogression. He circulates his critique to party leaders, but they don't even publish it until 15 years later. And this party eventually becomes the German Social Democratic Party, SPD, whose views predominate in concepts of socialist organization from then on. More than 27 years ago, Raya Donevskaya, during the last few years of her life, calls on Marxists to work out theory that could fill what she termed the void in organization ever since the CGP. And here we are. So let's begin with the study questions, to which you may add your own questions and comments as we go along, or after we do these, have free whatever. Okay, so question one. In his covering letter to Bracha, Marx criticizes three things. One, the principles contained in the Goethe program. Two, the program itself. And three, the mistakes that the Eisenachers made in practice by going along with it. Can you please give a few examples of each of these from the CGP text and the letter to Bracha? Okay, now I'm going to take a speaker's list, so unmute yourself and call out your name.
Thoralf.
Who's that? Oh, Thora. Okay. Anybody else? All right, well, let's start with Thora. Over.
Yeah, hello. I've broke it down in like scientific terms, just a few words, and then I have the examples. So, the first question: there are logical fallacies, conflations, misconceptions, and misconstructions. So what does that mean, actually? First of all, is labor is not the source of all wealth, which Marx vehemently criticizes here. And this view totally ignores the fact that labor power is a force of nature, and therefore the person who only owns labor power is a slave to a person who owns the material conditions of labor. So that was one particular example, and the other one was that the legal conceptions do not drive the economic relations. It is actually the other way around. That's what Marx says, but the program says that legal drives economic. So this is what I thought under the first question. I have a few more examples, but I keep it brief, so I'd like to move on to the second question.
Thorak, will you limit yourself to the first question?
Yeah, that's what I mean, sorry. Question, there are one, two, and three in there. That's I move on to the second part.
Okay,
yeah?
Don't rush. Whatever you...
All right, okay.
Over.
Instead of coming together and just talk, Marx thinks that the party leaders should have sort of worked out some action first. No, sorry, they should have told the Lasallian leaders in advance that they want to haggle about principles rather than coming together and agree on some action. And Marx uses the term antifestum, so they actually get together before some action was taken. But Marx thinks it should have been the other way around again, which then sends the wrong signals to the world. And the third part, I thought the Eisenachers went along with the LaSalle dogma that wage is the price of labor. But Marx had worked out some time ago, before that, that wage is the price of labor power. And he thought that his Eisenachers should have known this better, because Marx sort of told them that, and they should have known. So overall, the philosophy of the program was one or two steps back in Marx's view. So that's it. I have no more to say than that.
Okay. That was very much some of the things Marx singled out. Who else would like to speak on this question?
It's Ravi here. I'll have a kick out if you like.
Just a second. I think I heard someone else also. Was that you, Stefan? Okay, you're very, very weak. So I'm gonna let Ravi speak first, and maybe you can try to figure out if you need to close the other apps in your computer or something. And then when Ravi's
just to interject here, Anne, I think it's probably not an issue with apps. It probably is his microphone. It sounds like I don't know, Stefan, what kind of microphone you're using, but if you could, I don't know, maybe try to move closer to it or something like that.
Okay. Well, yes, he wrote very bad mic. All right, but try changing position in relation to the mic, because that we found sometimes makes a big difference. Like speaking directly into it. All right, but let's have Ravi, and then as soon as Ravi says over, then let's have Stefan follow. Okay, over.
Well, it seems that the thing that's running through all those three points that have just been made is the need for historical specificity to understand the form of society as a particularly a capitalist society, and everything that entails in relation to the position of the working class within it. And it's the failure to maintain that clear view of the sort of specifics of capitalism as a social system that Marx is criticising the Gotha program as having muddied and made less clear, rather than building upon the achievements that he'd made previously. And I think that's the overriding thing that runs through the whole of the critique of the Gotha program. Over.
Stefan?
I can hear you, but very weakly. I don't know, maybe if you wanted to type in what you wanted to say and someone else could read it off. I don't know, Anne, how you want to address
that's
this.
That's really hard to do if you're saying more than two words. Why don't we try listening to Stefan? If people can't understand him at all, then we'll ask him to type while someone else speaks. Over.
I can't hear that.
Are there other people who can't hear at all? Can't make out the words?
Yeah, I can't either. Nor can I.
Okay. So, Stefan, you want to write us something or else just listen? I'm sorry. would someone else like to speak on this point?
Anne, yes?
Yes. Andrew?
Yes.
Go ahead.
First, just to, I think, kind of clarify the point that Toroff was addressing about the Marx's saying if you can't agree on principles, you know, don't compromise, just work out a program for common action. I think the point is that when you want to fight an enemy, you want as many people as possible, but Marx is saying that the party, the organization, should not just include everybody that you want to fight together with against the common enemy. It has to reflect what you're for. And if the LaSallian party, you know, was going to persist as they did, in their ideas, no party formation should have been established together with them. All you do is you, on a more day-to-day practical level, you say, okay, we fight together with you against this and against that. But I think the point is, by no means should they have been part of the same organization. And that goes to the question, which I think is the crucial question, is what is the role of a Marxist organization? And just to add a couple of things regarding the criticism of the principles contained in the Gotha program, Marx is very adamant against the nationalist perspective, the abandonment of an internationalist perspective, and this is after the First International and its legacy, the International Working Man's Association, and together with the nationalism is the sucking up to Bismarck and the call for state aid. So all of those are some of the principles that he's very much against, I think. What seems to me to be the overriding mistake made by going along with the program, the mistake made by the Eisenach party, was that they were so much in favor of party building, or as Dunayevskaya put it, they made a fetish of organization, you know, numbers and bigness, and the theoretical and philosophic principles took a back seat to that. And I think that pervades so many of Marx's criticism. Over.
Okay. Have we got someone else that wants to address this first question in its specificity? In
Paul,
other words, yeah.
Paul here.
Okay, Paul.
I'd like to ask Andrew a question, which is, given the comments he just made about Marx's suggestion that part of the problem here was the abandonment of an internationalist perspective in favor of a nationalist one. Andrew, do you see this as actually being, in some respects, the origin of the further betrayal that takes place in 1914? Over.
Andrew, do you want to answer that or not?
I think according to the rules set up, I should wait. I will, you know, in due time, say something.
Okay.
Over.
Let's see if someone who has not spoken wants to speak, and Andrew will remember the question, or someone else can address the question. It's a very interesting one. Yes.
Peter
J. Peter J., go ahead.
Yeah, so there are a couple of other things that Marx mentions in the letter. One problem is that by capitulating to the Lasallians in this way, the Eisenachers have kind of left a lot of space open for the anarchists and Bakunin in particular to criticise Marx and Engels, because they seem to be adopting precisely the kind of narrow nationalistic outlook that Bakunin kind of falsely criticises Marx and Engels for holding. The other thing is that Marx is also criticising a kind of organisational naivety on the part of the Eisenachers. He's saying that effectively they allow the Lasallians to have their conference before the Unity Congress. The Eisenachers don't say, we're going to argue over principles, we're going to put our position forward. They more or less, what does Marx say, surrender before those themselves who in fact need help. I mean, the Eisenachers are clearly theoretically in advance of where the Lasallians are, but they haven't. Part of the problem is precisely that, according to Marx, they haven't paid enough attention to organisational matters and have kind of just capitulated before LaSalle's kind of quite strange doctrines. Over.
Someone else?
Hi, it's Stephanie. I have something.
Okay, go ahead.
So this kind of it's global, but it's also specific to the question, because as I've been doing some other reading, and I was curious about the dynamic that was taking place internationally and within, or sort of across, within the parties and also across, you know, the national borders. And there were a lot of rumors that were flying around. So it sounded as if, let's see, just a second. Okay, so what I wrote was, the cover letter from its outset to Bracca clearly speaks to the fact that neither Marx nor Engels supported any of the program's principles, and it clarified that to make this uncommon knowledge, was vital because of the rumors supported by the party's foes, and that's the International Working Men's Associations, their party's foes, that Marx and Engels were secretly guiding the movements of the party that became known as the Eisenachers. And Bakunin was active in circulating some of this, apparently, and associating Marx with all of the programs and with Liebknecht's actions. So Marx saw it as his moral obligation to speak and write out and to not acknowledge by diplomatic silence a program that would totally demoralize the party. I think he was feeling maybe or aware that the Eisenachers used or were using the timing of the Unity Congress and the eagerness of the workers to unify the two parties and leveraging the insertion of their weak and damaging program of mandates and not of action, nor of a plan of organization for common action. So Marx recognized this as maybe a unilateral ploy to stifle dissent and lock other parties, in particular Marx and Engels' party, out of decision-making power. And the unity efforts came as a surprise, apparently, to him and to Engels. And even though they didn't oppose the efforts of unity itself, they felt that the unity efforts were not coming from the masses. The masses were being exploited. The energy of the masses and their eagerness to unify was being exploited by the leadership. That's it. Over.
Okay. I just want to note that Stefan is not writing us something. He's just going to listen. So, Stefan, I hope you'll write something in the email that will circulate, and we'll hear from you next week. I want to just add a couple words to what Steffi touched on and what Peter Jay touched on about what the hell was going on, you know, how did they get so outmaneuvered? It makes you wonder. It's true they weren't expecting a motion to unify the parties or whatever, but you still wonder if they themselves had any understanding of how unique their party was and how the fact that the other one had more members didn't mean they had to subordinate themselves to it. You understand that both these parties were very small at the time. They weren't anything like later socialist parties. And they should have been, by that time, imbued enough with Marxism to know that it had very little to do with LaSallianism and not to be gobbled up. So I'm with Marx and being shocked and amazed at certainly he's criticizing them for going along with that and for not holding their own meeting ahead of time to sort of like strategize, you know, and whatever might happen, what they would do. But mostly he's criticizing them for losing sight of their own principles and the theoretic achievements that he says they had achieved, meaning Marx's own work, the publication of Capital. I'm sure that these things are all going to come up again and again. But let me see if anyone else... the other thing I want to say, because no one's done it much, I made this a three-part question because I was trying to sort out what was a principled objection and where he was just saying, this program is just plain wrong, you know? and then the organizational conclusions, because I think it's important to see exactly what Marx was doing. Now, it's not always easy to say what's principle and what's factual because they're so mixed up. You know, equitable distribution derives from misunderstandings about the fact that distribution follows production instead of production determining, instead of production following distribution. But certainly the most blatant principled problems with this document are, first of all, calling on the state, Bismarck, of all people, to do things for them, including funding the workers' co-ops, not even being able to identify properly the exploiter class, so that he leaves out the landowners. LaSallians do. Apparently they have something going with the with the landowning class. and the nationalism opposed to internationalism that people have pointed out. So you start with jettisoning your principles. You, in addition, misunderstand many, many key things about capitalism. and you have a mess. And there we are. So... let me just ask if does anyone else want to speak on question one?
Oh, hi. I've got Peter. You're the Peter.
Okay, Peter.
You know, I'm not playing devil's advocate, but I think Carl Liebknecht was, he was writing, you know, of course, with the LaSallians, but also he was looking at, I think, the constraints of... German law and the fact that it was an autocracy, and obviously he completely lost sight of the ball, but I don't know whether that was a factor in being outmaneuvered on the day, because I think you'll find that there was an obsession within German social democracy about, you know, the fact that they're going to be arrested at any time if they breached some of the harsh laws that restricted free speech. Over.
Okay. Any other questions, comments about question one? All right. Hearing none, I'm going to move on. But if you let me just say this in general. If you get passed by because you forgot to unmute yourself, don't worry. You can always say what you wanted to say later. But let's hear from Torev now.
I don't know. I wanted to address the question that came up about the betrayal of the international side of the party. And I don't know if Andrew wants to address this first, because he mentioned it first, or he thought he can add something. So I can wait. Yeah, I thought maybe Andrew wants to say it wants to address the question first, because he was asked first, and then I can comment on it. Over.
Andrew, I hear a groundswell wanting to discuss the international issues.
Right.
So let's do it here. It doesn't matter really where we do it.
Right. I am not by any means an expert on the history of the German social democracy, or what was going on there politically prior to the First World War. But my suspicion is that the Lasallian nationalism probably did not have all that much to do with, you know, the betrayal of the workers and voting, you know, of loans to fight the war. My suspicion is that the other aspect that we're dealing with here is the separation of philosophy and organization. I suspect that had a lot more to do with it, wherein, just as a matter of practical politics, the war was going to happen. You didn't want to be looked at as unpatriotic. You still had to function. People decided to be opportunistic, and you know, result was mass bloodshed. It seems to me that is kind of how the party worked all the way through, and that was the culmination, the betrayal of the workers by the party to, you know, sanction World War I. That was kind of the culmination of the separation that was going on for a very long time. It might be that, you know, there was a strong nationalist strain in the party. I'm not real familiar with it, so I really can't comment on that aspect. But I'm not aware of any such issue at the time. Over.
Let me just say one word. I'm sure Thoroff knows much more about this than I, but he may not realize how stupid Americans are about history. Let's remember that Germany was just finishing a period of unification at this time. They had been going through all these political upheavals and changes, right, about Prussians and Bismarck versus the Austrians and the Holy Roman Empire, if I've got it right. And so there probably was in the general culture all kinds of nationalistic appeals, and we know how dangerous that can be. But knowing what an opportunist LaSalle was, he probably just thought, well, it's easier to appeal to the workers on the basis of nationalism, a curse that has been with us for centuries and continues. And particularly since, you know, he thought the workers were backward and were not contributors to theoretic development the way Marx did. He had less interest in raising an internationalist flag. But that's just my opinion. Let's hear from Thoreff.
Okay, I have, because I'm a party member, not the SPD, but the left party, I have been, exposed to some extent to the SPD politics, and I had an opportunity to observe it firsthand. And I have always wondered, even remembering my history lessons, why the SPD does the following thing over and over again. In the run-up to big decisions, they toot and they shout and they say, oh, we must not do this and we must make sure the interests of the workers are met and this and all that. But on the day, when they cast the vote in parliament, they fall over. The vote then goes the other way and they cozy up to the conservatives and the bourgeois parties. And they have been doing this. I can give you 5-6 examples. Maybe one is when the 1914 war broke out. They said, "Oh, we won't support the war funds. We won't support the war funds." And then in the end, they did. And in 1917, during the revolution, one of their leaders, I forget the name, made actually a phone call to the head of the head of state, what do you need from me, and stuff like this. This is the SPD is sort of a phenomenon in that respect. I can't explain it. That's all I wanted to say. Just give a few examples of how they behave. Over.
Okay, well, you know, we can't put all that on the Lasallians in 1875, but it's good to think about where, you know, what happens when you start off your party on the wrong foot. I'm going to move to question two because time is passing. Will, would you try Brendan and Mikhail and anyone else who's missing once more before you give up?
This is Brendan. I'm not missing. I'm here.
Oh, well, hi, Brendan.
Yeah, I've been trying Mikhail, and he's just not online is the problem. There's nothing I can do unless his icon hasn't popped up as being on Skype once, so I don't think he's at a computer.
I guess he gave up and went back to sleep.
As far as I can tell, he was never actually there, so.
Oh, I saw in the beginning, though. Well, I don't know if it was on or just trying.
Yeah, his name comes up whenever you call, but that doesn't mean he's there.
Will?
Yeah.
Thing on Skype whereby you can add people to the call. So you don't. I'm not sure what you're referring to that you're using to try to add him, but there might be just a way.
No, I am. His that's what I've been doing, but his icon indicates that he is not online on Skype.
Right. And
there's no way of answering the call if you're not online on Skype. And I don't believe he has, as far as I know, since he became the one person who was not joined in, he has not been online once. So I think he just hasn't been at his computer.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, what a shame. Question two. Why does Marx lambast seemingly benign distortions of truth in the Gaza program, such as, quote, labor is the source of all wealth, and, quote, the proceeds of labor belong undiminished with equal right to all members of society, close quote. In other words, what's so bad about getting these not quite right? This is me. What can we discern about his view of the relation of theory to organization from the critique and the letter? And as Donevskaya's conclusion on page 155 of the Rose Luxemburg book, is it justified about the relation of theory to organization? So who would like to speak on this?
This is Brendan. I could say a couple brief things.
Sure.
Shall I just go ahead now?
Yes.
Okay.
Over.
For one, I mean, I think he does a good job of quickly taking what seems to be somewhat benign problems and elaborating on his critique enough so that one realizes that there's actually some pretty important distinctions to be made. He also makes the point later, especially in relation to the iron law of wages, that sometimes what, and this I don't think you get, and maybe it's not as obvious to the reader nowadays, but that some of these, there's sort of like these coded language that is appealing to the LaSallian faction in just the language itself, like undiminished proceeds of labor. And that they're just sort of, so some of that's just the sort of the politics of the relationship of the two factions to each other, the incorporating these sort of, I can't remember what the phrase he uses in relation to iron law wages, but anyway, sort of appealing to sort of a coded appeals in that way. But Marx is also, he points out at one point that he's worked really hard to advance his sort of scientific understanding of the capitalist mode of production, and it's obviously demoralizing to him that the party wants to take a step backwards and adopt these sort of vague and often wrong or misworded things in the platform. And the fact that he takes the time to critique them means that he thinks that the work, the theoretical work the party's done or that he's done, and the sort of organizational work he's done to try to promote his understanding of the capitalist mode of production is really important work and crucial to what the party is doing, and it's not something that you can just sort of let slide. He thinks that there's immediate role this has in how an organization goes about the task of being an organization. That's not just some sort of the theoretical stuff. It's not some, I don't know, condiment on the side of what an organization does. Over.
I like that condiment. Who else would like to address this?
I'd like to speak. I'm Ravi.
Okay, Ravi. Over.
I mean, I think that the kind of use of imprecise language, which in a roundabout kind of way gets to a similar sounding position as the one that you're supposed to be showing affinity to, it's one of those things where sometimes from the outside it looks harmless enough, and you think, okay, well, it's kind of saying the same thing, but it's precisely that wriggle room that people have got that allows for a divergence of different views, and the greater the precision and clarity with which you express something, iron fast guarantee that you're going to get it right, but the less room there is for a misinterpretation and for things to be heading off in a different direction. So that's why a kind of precise articulation of what you represent is always important, even when at times it seems as though it's a bit of a fuss over nothing, because sometimes it takes a little bit of development to show why that original principle that you're standing on is of significance. Over.
Okay, I'd like to call on people who have not spoken yet. There are quite a few, so I'm going to wait a moment to see if any of them will come forward.
This is David. I'd like to jump in.
Okay, David, go ahead.
Just a very brief observation. I think that, or maybe a little bit of a guess too, I think that the Gotha program was intended to draw more people into their banners, but they sacrificed some of the sharpness of critique in order to bring more people in, you know, into the fold, so to speak. And ended up creating this really banal, very general statements that weren't very challenging to capitalism itself. And one of the things that Marx is saying is that if you sacrifice the pointedness of the message only to, for, you know, a short-term increase of numbers, then it's not going to, you know, further the long-term revolutionary goals.
Okay. Somebody's either rustling papers or didn't mute themselves or both or something, because there's noise, so please double check. Okay, that was American David. The other one isn't here. British one. Okay, how about other people who have not yet spoken? Speak up if you want. Okay, how about people who have spoken, but just once? Do any of them want to speak on this question, too?
Sure, this is Stephanie. Can I? I'll
be yes.
Okay, yes. I'll just put the call out, because Anne has been encouraging people. I was, I still consider myself an infantile Marxist, and I was terrified when I started participating with the group. There was another Skype group last year, and people were very encouraging and kind, and I learned a lot, and I learned more by, you know, listening and then getting ready to speak. And, I was glad that I had the format of, you know, sentences to help get my thoughts in place about what I was reading. So I'll just respond a little bit to question two. I think that Marx understood at a deep level that the essence of the Unity Program was a sellout that undermined the workers' collective, social, economic, and political power in Germany and had the potential to mislead by example, hence having a disastrous effect on the international workers' movement. So his strategy was to dismantle the thing piece by piece in a very legalistic way to show how weak its foundations were, and whether the leadership call these foundations mandates, principles, or any other name, they were fundamentally flawed or even lies, given the realities historically and currently at that time of the working class in Germany and abroad. All the mandates, as they were called, were couched in a perspective that sought to have a social democratic capitalist state influenced by working people's or working men's demands. Only one real social demand was made anyway. It was that of state aid. So for both Marx and Engels, the distortions of truth were not benign. They were malignant, and they were based on unrealistic views of history and economics and theory. And hence, they disregarded the workers' power at a real basic level, locally, nationally, and internationally. A capitalist state cannot be used as a tool by workers to advance their situations within that state. It must be overthrown by the workers who must take over social, economic, and political power. And that's it. No. Over.
Okay, I'll vote for that. Anyone else want to speak on this question?
Peter Jones.
Okay. Go ahead.
I really agree with the stuff about imprecise wording leaving space for wriggle room. I mean, it's not enough just to have people grouped together who have good intentions, who, you know, are very against capitalism and want to do something to get rid of it, you also need kind of clear agreement about what it is you're actually fighting for positively. I think those are really important points. The other problem is that the program was calling for stuff that doesn't actually make any sense, that couldn't be implemented, like the undiminished proceeds of labour. I mean, Marx goes through and shows why that wouldn't make any sense in a socialist society, in any society, really. And if you kind of allow stuff like that in as well, it just sort of, it says to the world, our program, we're not even really all that serious about it. You know, we're putting stuff in that can't even really be achieved, or that we haven't really kind of fleshed out theoretically. It's just kind of banners around which to rally more people, which I think is a problem as well. Over.
Yeah, I think I'll just add that when you distort the actual workings of capitalism, as the program did, you hold out the illusion that there may be easy solutions, right? That Bismarck will give the money for co-ops, that Bismarck will change the system so that there's equal distribution under capitalism or something like that. You don't just say stupid things, but you mislead the very people to whom you should be discussing the workings of capitalism, that is, all the workers, so they can understand what exactly it is they have to do away with to change the mode of production. Anybody else on this question?
You're the pizza. Can I say something?
Yes.
You know, I mean, I agree with everything that's been said about, you know, getting it wrong in 1875 was a seminal moment. But, you know, Engels had 20, you know, we talk Marx and Engels a lot. Engels had 20 years, really, after the critique. After the critique, to basically to hammer some sense into Babel and Karl Leibniz. And, you know, it seems, I mean, we say Marx and Engels, don't we, as though it's one person. But it appears in the correspondence, if you look at the correspondence between Engels and Babel, or Engels and Leibniz, but Engels and Babel in particular, it appears that Engels seemed also to buy in to the SPD as a, you know, a party project. He appeared to, you know, oh, I don't know whether maybe other people have got a different view on this. My interpretation, my view is that, or my assessment of the facts is that, I mean, Engels had a very, particularly in the 1890s, he appeared to think the SPD would be the vehicle through which the working class would take power. And there's a lot of evidence, there's some incredible statements when you go into it. So, you know, is there a difference to others to discern a difference in, you know, this party program between Marx and Engels in the same way that I look at it? Because, you know, it was screamingly obvious, I think, by the 1890s that there were big problems that got worse and worse between the theory and the practice of the SPD. Over.
Okay. Anyone else who's not spoken want to speak on number two?
I would like to speak.
I'd like to go after Andrew.
All right, just keep your eye on the clock, because this is only the second question. Who was that wants to go after Andrew?
Mike.
Oh, Mike. I'm sorry.
Why doesn't Mike go first? Because he hasn't spoken.
Yes, all right, Mike, then Andrew.
Sure, just to try and, if not address the last part of the question, to give some of my thoughts about it. The question is phrased, what can we discern about Marx's view of the relation of theory to organization from the critique and the letter? Is Dunyevskaya's conclusion about their relation justified? And it seems like on page 155 of the Rosa Luxemburg,
can't hear you.
Oh, sorry, I just muted my... I muted the mic.
Yeah, we only heard on page 155 of the Rosa Luxemburg book, and then you went out.
Right, okay. So, she talks about, you know, not only did Marx send the critique and the covering note, but he also said, he also wrote a note that said, in the near future, the last parts of the French edition of Capital will be coming, and references to a new edition of the 1852 Revelations Concerning the Communist Trial in Cologne. And then she goes on, and Dunayevskaya says, in a word, 1875 was a most active year politically, philosophically, and organizationally, none of which was separable from both the philosophy of revolution and the perspectives for the future. So to him, to Marx, rather, it was kind of, it seemed all of a piece. What Anne was saying before about those imprecision, maybe being... What comes into a vacuum of not understanding, either really getting what capitalism is, or thinking that you can solve it by shortcuts or state intervention or something. But here is Marx kind of sending his critical marginal notes, as he called them, but you know, a new part of Capital and his critique of political economy, and he felt it relevant enough to mention along with the critique. So I guess that's Dunayevskaya felt that was important. I also want to mention one thing that is later on that she says, I guess on the next page, where Marx analyzes what's totally wrong, and when not wrong, quite imprecise, is the program's analysis of labor and its subordination to what Marx called, quote, the monopoly of the means of labor, where, end quote, where for the First International, the class of monopolists included both capitalists and landowners, LaSalle had spoken as if it were only the, quote, a monopoly of the capitalist class, end quote, thus letting the Prussian landowners, by no accident, off scot-free. And of course, the sort of reference to his secret pact with Bismarck there. So I guess that's not just an imprecise language, as she says, but I don't know, what maybe like a sin of omission, as a Catholic would call it. Over.
Okay. Anybody else on question three? How about our Kansas City students? We haven't heard from them. They're quiet.
You mean question two?
Yeah, yes, two. Oh, I can't count. All right, I'll move to three. Near the end of section three of the critique is a vision of communism that everybody loves in the paragraph about the, quote, higher phase of communist society. It ends, quote, from each according to her ability to each according to her needs. But there's been a lot of debate over his description earlier in the section of the prerequisite lower phase of communism, quote, as it emerges from capitalist society. Now, we're going to go into this much more deeply than we have time for today in some future classes, but I'd like to get a handle right now on it so that people don't, when they're rereading and rereading the CGP, they're not confused. So I'd like to have a little discussion on whether that description of the lower phase of communism, he is saying that there has been a complete break with capitalism, or whether he's saying that the society then is just a little bit communist. Can we have some discussion, please?
This is Eric. I'd like to have a comment. CGP, I got the impression that he considered it a complete break. It was a period. It was the period after the dictatorship of the proletariat, and the means of production had been socialized. It's just that there were parts of society that were still stamped with the birthmark of, or with the mark of capitalism. So he mentions, at this point, there would be, while the means of production are socialized, there would be a labor voucher system where people would have probably the opportunity to accrue an equitable amount of labor vouchers or wealth, as it were. So that feature of capitalism would still be present in a communist society, probably because means of production, and there hasn't been free access granted to everyone just yet. But it's still a socialist mode of production. So there's kind of a dual nature. It is communist, but there's still some vestiges of capitalism we have to deal with. Over.
Okay, someone else on this question.
I'll speak on this, Anne.
Who's that?
It's Ravi.
Oh, Ravi. I'm sorry, I'm not good on voices, particularly on Skype. Okay, Ravi, go ahead.
Well, I think that Marx's whole presentation of the idea of right being a necessarily bourgeois notion is quite interesting, because he's saying any attempts to say that your entitlement is based off this is necessarily bourgeois in character, because it's to do with the scope of society to meet people's needs. And on top of that, rather than labour being the expression of a free human being, it's still essentially one there where there is an element of compulsion in it, because at this stage it's not sufficiently productive where it's a free association without our problems. And I think that's the sort of insight about the birthmarks of capitalism still being there, even though society has been created on a new basis, it's not entirely done away with the vestiges of the old society, and there are certain ways of thinking that have yet to be transformed that are based on the previous mode of production. Over.
Anne?
Yes. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I would like to elaborate. I agree with what Eric said. It is a complete break. He mentioned that the means of production are socialized, and there are several other things that Marx points to as being different. I mean, first of all, he just says within the cooperative society based on the common ownership of means of production, and then he lists differences from capitalism, and that applies to both the initial phase of communist society and the higher phase. So in addition to there's common ownership of the means of production, the producers do not exchange their products. And when he talks about the lower phase, he explicitly mentions that again. There's an exchange of labor, so to speak, but there's no exchange of product. And then he says here, within the cooperative society, blah, 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 just as little does the labor employed on the products appear here as the value of these products. As an objective quality possessed by them. So we have a society without value and the production of value. And you can see that in his description of the lower phase of communism, there's no value. And indeed, he says that the individual's labor will count according to the amount of work that they do, rather than the value of the product that is produced by the amount of work that they do. There's a difference between counting the actual amount of labor and the abstract value created by that labor, so to speak. And then he goes on and says, since now, in contrast to capitalist society, individual labor no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly as a component part of the total labor. Or in short, it's a move from a system of indirectly social labor to a system of directly social labor. And that's something he's been developing really for decades. So all of this applies to the whole of the communist society that he's envisioning, both the initial phase and the higher phase. And you can see the lower phase of communism is such that there is directly social labor because he says, you know, what somebody furnishes is an amount of labor, what they get back is an amount of labor, and it immediately counts as such. It's not like it has to be mediated such that, oh, what you produce has to sell, and then it counts as labor, and if it's unsaleable, then it doesn't count as labor. No, it just immediately counts as labor. So it's directly social, and the amount of labor directly counts as what it is. Now, you know, there's that question of what is retained in, both Eric and Ravi have addressed, what is retained, it's still a carryover or birthmark or whatever from, you know, capitalism. And yeah, I think he's just trying to work out there the problem in the word fair, when you talk about the fair distribution. And Marx is saying that the principle of fairness that would initially prevail would in a certain sense be the same as that of capitalism. Rather than from each according to her ability to each according to her needs, that wouldn't be feasible yet. And that principle would be the principle of equal exchange. But still here there's a huge difference because we're not talking about exchange of products, first of all. And second of all, he says that in capitalist society, that principle of equal exchange does not apply in the individual case. In other words, you don't like supply an hour's worth of labor and get back the product of an hour's worth of labor because it's mediated through the value stuff. So principle and practice are at loggerheads, and that would not exist in even the initial phase of communist society. So I think it's easy to read him as suggesting that there's more of a carryover than I think he actually meant, just because to make his point he belabors it. I think it's really limited to that one point about exchange of equal amounts of whatever. Over.
Torvalf.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I wanted to elaborate on this because in the brief it said that this point has been much reason for or much cause of debate. I think the reason why Marx labels this point is, yes, it is a break, but it's not a break in a sense that the new society has been designed at on the drawing board. He wants to put the point across that the new society develops, comes out of the contradictions of capitalism. And even in the lower phase, these contradictions have been, what's the technical term in the dialectic? I think it's sublated. They no longer exist, the contradictions. And yeah, the connection with the ode is still the labor time, although it counts differently now, and it's still the division of labor, which only is overcome in the higher phase of capitalism, when the division between mental and manual or physical labor has also been sublated or overcome. So again, it's not a thing that comes out of a drawing board, but rather out of the old, but still constitutes a break. Over.
Anyone else on this question? Yeah, I'll just reiterate what people have said about it being a complete break. That the difference between working to produce value for capitalism to grow and expand and working to produce things for human need is so enormous that it's just got to be seen as a complete break. And when I wrote, "Is it just a little bit communist?" I was being facetious. I don't think it can be a little bit communist anymore, and you can be a little bit pregnant. You know, you're either engaged in value production or you're not. You're engaged in another kind of what Marx calls freely associated labor. So I think we've got to get that. Now, that doesn't mean it's a perfect society by any means, and he makes that clear when he talks about there's still all these problems. Some people can work more hours than other people. You know, some people are whatever. So it's nothing like that ultimate vision of the higher phase of communism. But think a little bit about how unlikely that's going to come about quickly. I mean, certainly not in his day, but not even in our day, where we don't yet have the productive capacity for everybody in the world to be able to have everything they want. To reach according to her need means, you know, you want it, you get it. We're nowhere near that material basis for the higher phase, let alone what kind of other changes would be needed for people to think that that's okay if some people get more than them. So I think it's important to appreciate this lower phase and not to confuse what he's talking about, that is, you get to take out goods that took as many hours to produce as the hours you work, not to confuse that with capitalist schemes for labor chits, which have been common throughout history and still are, where the labor chits are merely substituting for money, but having the exact same function. No, we've gotten rid of money. We're compensating people for the for their hours of labor. And it's very, very different. Okay, anything else on question three from anyone?
Hi, Sudeep from Kansas City.
Hi, Sudeep. Go ahead.
I'd just like to add something here. I think we need to make a clear distinction between an economic transition period and a political transition period. I think, there is a political transition period because socialism represents a permanent revolution. So there is some sort of, you know, transition from capitalism to communism. But I don't think Marx means that there is a corresponding economic transition period, because the in-between mode of production does not really make sense. It's either capitalism or not. You know, so I think we need to make a distinction between an economic and a political transition period. Over.
Okay. This is going to come up again, so you're a good candidate to talk about or write questions for class four. anyone else on question three?
Anne, I'd like to make a comment. This is Paul.
Okay, Paul.
I think it's interesting because when we talk about the difference between an economic transition period and a political transition period, Marx also, of course, uses the famous phrase that the political transition period is one in which the state can be nothing but the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. And I think it's interesting because I don't see how it's possible to have political transitions that are sort of continuous, but economic transitions that are discrete. In other words, it seems to me that it's a mistake to say we have either capitalism or communism. We can certainly separate the two modes of production in principle, but it seems to me that the way history works, what we're going to wind up with are a whole series of transitions, as is illustrated by the fact that even contemporary capitalism contains within itself vestiges of prior production relations, as well as presumably foreshadowing of future production relations. It seems that if there's going to be any kind of relationship between economic transitions and political transitions, you can't have discrete economic transitions that at the same time call for political transitions that are, sort of on a continuum as opposed to discrete. Anyway, that's the point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Okay. We only have another, a little over a half hour. Oh, shit. Hold on a second. I forgot to lower my phone. Go away. I'm sorry. Dr. Hugh, thyself. I forgot to put on the list. Lower the volume on your telephones. I'm going to move to question 4. This is from early in section 4 of the Gothic program critique. Quote, and what of the riotous misuse which the program makes of the words, quote, present day state, present day society, and of the more riotous misconceptions it creates in regard to the state to which it addresses its demands, close quote. Okay, and this sort of goes along with what we were just talking about. Why is this riotous? And would Marx think it's still riotous in modern-day democracies to treat society and the state this way? Or does the CGP allow us to believe he might think that we can modify capitalism so as to change whom or what the state serves? Who would like to take this up?
To Ralf, briefly.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the first part is, at least what I think it is, the statements are openly non-revolutionary and they are submissive to the ruling class. And in a way, we still have this issue today. And I don't think we can modify capitalism because we have to modify the production relations. We can't modify them. We have to completely change them, as we have discussed under question 3. Over.
Someone else.
This is David. I'd like to say something.
Sure. Go ahead.
I think that this is purely, you know, subjective or whatnot, but whether or not Marx would find this amusing today, I think, well, it's a baffling situation how much we've been through since this time period, and as someone said earlier, we in a very broad way do make many of the same mistakes. I think part of the mistake is this continual modification of capitalism. I mean, even in the United States, the Health Care Act that passed recently is an attempt to modify capitalism, and many people here, very ignorant people, you know, scream that this was socialism. This is you know, any kind of state intervention being socialism. But you can't help but laugh. I mean, objective, you know, maybe you can't help but laugh, but it's still, like, so frustrating that you have to take some kind of amusement in it. The way that the system does try to at least make some room to take the steam off of popular discontent. So, trying to think of a way to relate that back to the broader question and having a little trouble. I apologize.
Okay. Anyone else? No. Nobody else? Okay. Well, no, I think you've all got that. It was a funny thing to say when Germany was under dictatorship, but it's still absurd to think capitalism is going to change. And it's I think the main point here is the state is a reflection of the economic system. It's not an independent entity. This is in section 4. You can't treat the state as an independent entity that possesses its own intellectual, moral, and free basis. And this is a theme we'll return to over and over in these classes, as to what drives what. You know, does the state drive the economic conditions or vice versa? Does distribution drive production or vice versa? What's going on here? So, okay, I'm going to move to question 5, unless someone wants to say something else before I do.
So, Ralph, quick interjection on number 5.
Okay, let me read the question out first, yep. Torov, all right? Donaevskaya argues that all post-Marx Marxists, including Luxembourg, extolled LaSalle as the organizational expert because he built a relatively large German party, even though Marx had founded and played a huge part in several international organizations. Why does she say this elevation of LaSalle over Marx on organization happened? Has the left's organizational emphasis on numbers rather than philosophy changed a lot since that time? And I refer you to Donaevskaya's page 157, not for one answer, but the entire discussion that actually starts earlier. It's that whole chapter. Torov.
Yeah, I'd like to read that one quote, the important quote on page 157. Labor, from a mere means of life, has itself become the prime necessity of life. I think, after having read the German original of the critique of the Gotha program, necessity is the wrong word. Necessity implies, at least in my mind, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that people still have to sell their labor power to make a living. But Marx actually uses the word Bedürfnis, which translates as want. So Marx is actually talking about a desire, labor as a desire. Okay, over.
And I'll comment on this. This is Ravi again.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand, Torp, you're referring to the prime necessity of life. You're saying that should be the prime want of life or the prime desire of life, right?
Want, yeah, want is a better word.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound as nice as this as a necessity, but want is actually correct.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty much the same thing, at least in American English. In other words, I'll let other people speak. Go ahead.
I think that it's clear in the context in which the whole program's written that he's talking about the labor itself becomes an expression of I can't remember the wording, but it's in there about the expression of a free human being or something to that effect, and I'll leave it at that. Over.
Who else on this question? Of LaSalle as the expert on organization and Marx having nothing to say.
Yeah?
Yes, Andrew?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In the...
Andrew, we can't hear you. Did you mute yourself?
I'm sorry. Yeah. On page 157, the big long paragraph, in the middle of that, this is the paragraph right after Prime Necessity of Life, she says that how could Rosa Luxemburg, who was the greatest internationalist, not have seen any of this? It could not have been national versus international, because she was strongly on the international side. So it wasn't a problem that way. She says it could have only been activism versus philosophy. Okay, so that's the answer to why they elevated LaSalle over Marx, because their idea of a party was, you know, an activist formation, basically separated from philosophy. And then she says, okay, the CGP could not win adherence if the German social, in the German social democracy, that can be understood, if the issue was who had the big party, the mass party, Marx of LaSalle. So then she goes on to, well, why didn't anybody, you know, and that includes Lenin, I guess, later on, who looked at the Critique of the Gotha program as the actual perspective for a whole movement. In other words, why didn't anybody split from this conception of a party as being an activist formation separate from philosophy? And she says that's nearly fantastic, and she doesn't mean fantastic good, it means fantastical, seems to me. So, with regard to the last question in five, has the left's organizational emphasis on numbers rather than philosophy changed a lot since that time? I don't think so. I think we're facing the same issue. And I think it's really hard to get any real engagement with Marx's ideas as long as we have this problem. And I think it's the same problem that we face continually that's reflected in the Gotha program. I mean, they love the ideas, blah, 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 but not when it's a matter of making that concrete in an organizational sense. Then philosophy takes a back seat or is held as, well, that's your own opinion, and party organization is thought to be divorced from that. And I think we need a lot of discussion as to why that is. I don't think it's a simple matter. Why do people do this? What is their conception of social change? And what was Marx's conception of social change, such that to one side, theory seems separate and philosophy seems separate. And for Marx, you know, he seems almost to be nitpicking over the most minor points and saying, you know, on the basis of this, I'm going to have nothing to do with your organization. Over.
This is Stephanie. I'd like to say something if no one else has anything to say now, but I can wait.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is in light of what everybody else has been saying in response to this question, and I'm rereading that part, that those two paragraphs, and what's coming to mind is Marx was speaking, wrote about it with his critique that it was a retrogression, and it's as if the people that were putting the programs together, and when I say that, I mean back then, and I'm talking about what's come since and what we're still dealing with now, is that it's as if the revolutionary ideas, well, they're already set out there, and the only thing left to do, so to speak, is to organize, create programs, and revise the language, and again, that the seeking of large numbers. I mean, in Minnesota, we have people who keep talking about we've got to create this mass labor party as if that's going to solve our problems. And we're steeped in this party tradition in Minnesota, and also super hyper to the point of like it's almost a disease. People who want to organize and manage things, and I feel as if the people that, you know, put the Gotha program together were exceedingly fine managers and organizers, and of course that, you know, the idea of the fetishizing of organization versus keeping all the pieces together, the philosophy and theory and action, that got tabled, and the idea became if we can just organize this the right way, and again using the right language to pull as many people in as possible to get everybody at the table, so to speak, we're going to solve everything. Over.
Can I say something?
I'm sorry, who's that?
It's the other Peter. Peter from the girl's photograph on it.
Okay, Peter, go ahead. I couldn't remember G or J. Go ahead, Peter.
No, I've underlined the part that says, precisely the part that says, on page 157, it could only have been activism versus philosophy. And that is the key point. You know, when I joined, like, it must be donkeys years ago, when I first joined, my introduction to Marxism, it was kind of, I didn't know what I was joining because I was interviewed without my knowing it. And you went through a process to join this organization that was concentrated on theory. And then, around about 1992, in England, the poll tax movement, it kind of changed from being one of, you know, theory to one of raising money. And, you know, you need to raise money in order to get, like, full-timers for this organization. And the full-timers go out and then they raise money, and then you have further targets for more full-timers and more money. And at some point, I don't know how it changed or why it changed or whether this is inevitable or not inevitable, but it's a barrier anyway at some point that organizations cross when you hit a certain threshold. And people think that you can make it to a mass organization, whether there's a desperate tendency to throw the theory out the window, but there's a tendency to say, well, look, the theory can wait. I think the previous speaker, Stephanie, as it said, you know, let's just leave it. Let's just get on. We already know the theory. I've heard that. In fact, Stephanie, I've heard that statement. Look, we've already heard the idea. We just need to get out there and organize. of course, it is very important, and I don't know too much about Minnesota, but of course it's a great thing to have, you know, a mass workers' party, and it's fantastic, and, you know, I'm all in favour of building for it. So I'm not downplaying the people who were saying those things. However, it's, you know, if you look at, say, some of the leading proponents of this movement towards building the mass workers' parties, and yeah, it's great, but you know, I'm reminded that there's a quote from Babel. Babel said, and Babel's caught in the horns of a dilemma. He said, you know, he actually, he knew Engels, he knew Marx, he was, you know, and he, but he was trying to build this workers' party. And if you look at Babel's schedule for the day, it's like 10 hours of organising meetings. And in the end, there's a great quote. He says something like, "But there's no time for meditation. There's no time for philosophy." Something along those lines. Because he realized that there was this dichotomy, and it is at the peril of any organization that wants to build itself that you say, let's just leave it to one side. So I mean, that's the thing I took from that page 157. You can't. It's not a luxury. So let's have a philosophy class to study this. It is absolutely essential. At every stage of the building of any organisation, you have to look at philosophy. So I think that's a really important, well, that's the key point, isn't it? That's one of the key points, I think, you know, to get out of this session, I think, you know, Brazil. Over.
Hi, Anne, can I say something? This is Ruchira from Kansas City.
Yes, please. Go ahead, Ruchira.
I wanted to talk about this whole question of numbers versus philosophy. So there is this thing of internationalism. My question is more about parliamentary communist parties. So you have all these communist parties that go and stand for election. And as soon as they stand for election, they end up compromising on a lot of, you know, the basic tenets of Marxism, like, firstly, they become nationalistic already because I think it just becomes like a way of trying to get votes or trying to get, you know, people to agree with you. So in this whole populism that occurs, could it be tied up with the Communist Party standing for election? Should they stand for election? And I wonder what Marx, in the light of the CGP, would think about that. Over.
I'd like to speak on this, Anne. Ravi again.
Ravi, let's just see if someone else does, because we have people who haven't spoken much. So let me just wait a moment. Anyone else?
Shane from Brisbane.
Okay, Shane, you go, and then Ravi after.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm thinking is just the balance to that position is that, you know, the movement matters, and what workers do matters, and where they're oriented matters, and that revolutionaries have to be involved at some level with where workers actually are, and that, you know, you can form, you know, what I'm not suggesting anyone is saying this, but, you know, there's that implication that we've got all our ideas right, we've got the right program, and then, and if we can't form an organisation around that, or we can't attract people, you know, a large number of people around it, then we can be satisfied with our philosophy. And I'm not saying anyone's saying that, but there is a balance. And it is about being engaged in a movement of people and trying to win them to your ideas. And that, and there's somewhere in the readings too, about, you know, the movement matters, not the program. So, you know, there's some sort of balance in there. Over.
Okay, anybody else on this question, which, believe me, we're not going to be done with today. Yes, go ahead. Oh, I forgot Ravi. Okay, Ravi.
All right, sorry. Yeah, sorry, Ravi, sorry.
Well, it's just that I think that I am going to dissent from Dinesh Gaya's presentation of all post-Marx Marxists have failed to integrate philosophy and organisation. I would exempt Lenin from that myself, because I think that the whole idea, well, I mean, if we use the word principle rather than philosophy, and say that an organization has to be an expression of a political, a very specific political orientation, then I think Lenin was very, very clear on that. And I think even early on, and I understand her points about the importance of going back to Hegel, and the break in his thinking was represented by the Second World War. But even the What Is to Be Done pamphlet and the split between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks was an argument of principle. I mean, it seems as though it was an organizational question as to do with the discipline of who was going to be considered a member of the party. But behind that is a very, very important understanding of what to operate in those conditions meant. And that is a question of principle. It's not just a technical matter. And in that sense, I don't think that her charge, that all of the post-Marxists are to be tarred with the same brush. I would exempt Lenin from that, but we can continue that on another discussion, I think.
I'm sure we will. And we don't have much more time, so let me just see. Wait, somebody else was going to speak on this question.
Torov?
Torov, okay, make it brief, please.
Yeah, very. It was very brief before we move on. The activism or action with numbers is a lot easier, a lot more practical, a lot more appealing than activism together with philosophy as a unified whole. It is very hard to bring the two together, so for practical and convenience reasons, the philosophy and the theory are too often left out. So over.
Okay, well, we're going to definitely come back to these questions. I'm going to write on the email in a few days, and certainly Ruchira, am I saying it right? No.
Yes, that's right.
All right. I certainly don't mean to ignore your question about what happens when people run for office. And is that, I think you're asking, is that a good political practice? And we have plenty to say about that in Marxist humanist history, where we didn't and don't do anything like that. But let me move on to question six, so at least we can touch on it, although we're not going to exhaust that either. Question six was on the basis of the CGP. What does Marx seem to mean in the letter to Bracha by, quote, every step of real movement is more important than a dozen programs? A couple people want to take a stab at that one. I don't hear anyone.
Torov,
I mean, I wrote out a whole speech, but I think maybe I'll save it for the email because I don't want to go over time, and I do want to allow some time for people to raise other questions. So you're not, in case you had other things you wanted to discuss tonight and they didn't fit neatly under these questions. So let me just ask if somebody wants to bring up whatever it is, some aspect of the readings that you didn't quite make sense out of, or anything we've said today that you're puzzling over. Let me just give everybody a minute to think.
I've got a suggestion on something that we might include in the readings, because given that Dineshkaya is critical of Lenin's What Is To Be Done, I think an examination of that and precisely what it is that, you know, the MHI thinks is problematic about it would be a useful discussion in terms of the separation of organisation and philosophy and where you think that comes through in What Is To Be Done.
Okay, Ravi, would you write that in an email to everyone and we'll see what people think.
Sure.
Certainly, he raised the question, what is to be done? But he didn't answer it in the terms that we're discussing now in relation to Marx. And that's why we didn't have any more readings or any. We talked about having supplemental readings, but we really couldn't find anything that actually addressed the question of what the critique of the Gotha program meant to anybody in history since then. Now, of course, Lenin wrote his whole thesis on that basis, but he didn't specifically address the question of organization, as I recall. So that's the issue. What is a Marx? What in particular did Marx have to say about organization? Not what to do, but what is this relationship? We were talking about it in the last question. The whole separate spheres of organization from philosophy. And how can that be broken down, or can it be broken down, or need it be broken down? Let's talk about that. Does anyone else have any comments, suggestions, observations about how this class went?
Yeah?
Yes.
I mean, I would actually like to hear what you've worked out with respect to question six, because Shane has already actually mentioned that in his comments. And if you don't want to, I would like to address question six.
Well, it's 3 minutes to six. Can people stay like till five after? I mean, six here. In other words, can you stay 8 more minutes?
Yeah, let's make four.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Yeah, I'm good.
Well, then let me try to address question six, and then you can come in too, or anyone else. Okay, the question was what Marx meant by every step of real movement is more important than a dozen programs. And this is something I've been puzzling over for years, because it sounds a bit like Marx is favoring spontaneous workers' actions over a party's theory or principles. And in fact, young Marxist humanists have often pointed to that sentence while arguing with anarchists who claim that Marx was a vanguardist and showing he wasn't. But I don't think that's right. We have to remember that the prevalent current duality in views an organization, that is spontaneity versus vanguardist, that is a 20th century phenomenon. In Marx's time, they didn't have vanguard parties in our sense, and there was not that kind of separation between the workers' movements and the parties. They were the same people. That said, I think this sentence is not about workers' movements, but rather about organizational movement, or what we probably say in English is development, the development of the organization and moving forward in ideas, in its thoughts about itself. At issue is how the party could go so backward from Marx's theoretical accomplishments and its own program. And we see in the rest of that paragraph, in the letter to Bracky, one sets up before the whole world a landmark by which the level of the party movement is measured. This is actually discussed at a little greater length by Engels in an earlier... I muted myself. Engels' letter to Babel on the Gotha program, March 18 to 28. As a rule, the official program of a party is less important than what it does. But a new program is, after all, a banner publicly raised, and the outside world judges the party from it. It should therefore on no account include a step backwards. So I conclude that Marx and Engels are saying a lot about what an organization's activity should consist of, not just in an immediate strategic sense, boy, you guys screwed up at Gotha, but saying that because its activities, its movement, its steps, its development are the way that it articulates and projects its philosophy or principles to the world. Now, this may seem like an obvious or fine point, but I think it's a different point from just saying no to unprincipled alliances. I don't think Marx is only saying that. I think the idea is closer to Dostoevsky's concept of basing organization in philosophy. This is a concept which I hope all of you will develop much further. But I'll just say now that I think Dostoevsky's thesis is that organization is not a sideline that comes from somewhere else or from a traditional form or from what the old left called project hatching. That is, you know, let's make up a campaign to raise the minimum wage or whatever. Rather, organization is both a part of the philosophy and it arises from it. Or put in terms of Hegelian dialectic, it's both substance and subject, developing out of philosophy and adding to philosophy's development. This, I think, is the basis of Dostoevsky's call to study the CGP as, quote, actual perspective for the whole movement. Over. Andrew.
That sounds very good to me. I have nothing to add. I think it's quite right, and I would like you to publish it because I want to study it some more because it went by rather quickly. Over.
Okay, I will. Tora, go ahead.
Quickly. Well, the difficulty with interpreting the sentence in the light of what we discussed is, what do we mean by the expression real movement? We should not equate real movement with action. The way I see this is, I see this dialectically. Action is the North Pole on a permanent magnet. Philosophy is the South Pole on a permanent magnet. And only when those poles come together as a unified whole do we have the magnetic effect. And the magnetic effect is real movement. Over.
This is Stephanie. I just have a quick suggestion, and it's for way in the future, maybe. But I like Ravi's idea about using Lenin's What Is to Be Done, but I think that could be like a whole nother Skype class. Over.
All right, maybe Ravi will break down his suggestion a little further for us, like exactly what he would want to cover and when in this class.
I'll do that.
Another. Okay, great. Who else would like to say something and have the last word?
Peter Jones?
Yes, Peter.
I guess the sort of alternative interpretation is immediately after that phrase, every step of real movement is more important than a dozen programs, Marx talks about how it would have been possible to conclude an agreement for action. He does seem to be saying, look, it would have been possible to take the real movement forward, which, I mean, I think he means the class struggle, really, by concluding an agreement for action that didn't sacrifice fundamental principles to the Lasallians. I mean, that's it. The way that he kind of italicizes that phrase, every set of real movement is more important than a dozen programs, and the fact that what he's doing is criticizing a program, he seems to me to be saying, you know, the criticism of the program isn't the whole point, but in these circumstances, it was very important to criticize this program because it was such an abandonment of, you know, principles that are very important. Over.
Okay, I actually had thought about asking, so now we're asking Torov if the word movement that Marx uses there, if the German throws some light on the question of whether he's talking about the development of the party or of the mass movement outside. If you want to think about that, you can let us know.
Yeah, in German, it's the word Bewegung, which is movement, but it's not like a train moving, or it's not like a car moving. It's movement is the thing. It's the class struggle, and I agree with what the previous speaker has said. I see real movement as class struggle. But class struggle can only consist of action and philosophy as a unified whole. Only then can you get proper class struggle. Over.
Okay, Torf, I'm gonna question you further, not in class about this, because I think you may be assuming what has to be proved. Because, as I say, I went through a lot of changes on this and came out with a different take on it. anybody else? You're all entitled to say something. Maybe people want to go. All right, anyone want to give us a little feedback right now as to this class before you depart?
Shane from Brisbane. I just wanted to say I've enjoyed it and look forward to the next one.
Ruchita, it was pretty good and I enjoyed it and will prepare a lot better for the next class. And it's really, it's motivating me to read further and find out and learn more.
Okay, great. Anybody else? Shall we say good night?
Night.
There's a big wind, so I think we'll say goodnight. Let me know right away if you don't want your email circulated. Otherwise, I'm going to get out the list so that everybody can write. Everybody. Okay? All right. You're very welcome, and thank you, and good night, and I hope it's nice wherever you are.